This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Flooding, drought, and wildfires are happening all over the world. Why? And why did scientists leave out models showing extreme warming? UK expert Ranjini Swaminathan takes us inside the future forecast machine. Then we revisit ecofeminism. U.S. Green Party founder Charlene Spretnik and Susan Griffin on women and nature, speed, consciousness, and quantification. That's from the Forum in Chicago, Techno-Utopianism and Fate of the Earth. This is Radio EcoShock. As global temperatures go higher than expected, why did official science avoid models suggesting higher than expected temperatures? Does that matter for big impacts like flooding, drought, or wildfires? What drives them? We get a flurry of questions from a humble paper that at first glance appears to be a discussion among experts on climate modeling. Fortunately, we have the lead author to explain. Dr. Ranjini Swaminathan is an expert in climate modeling at the University of Reading. Yes, she has published on cognitive robot systems and pattern recognition, but she tends to ask real questions affecting billions of people. How can we think about a very different future? From Reading, UK, Ranjini Swaminathan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk about my paper on behalf of my co-authors. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you here. And your group studied regional climate drivers for things like fire and monsoon flooding. Very important, always hits the news. Is there really any global climate change, or is it all a collection of interacting regional changes?
That's a good question. And the short answer is yes, there's definitely global climate change, and that's a certainty. And this global climate change, as you are already aware, is primarily due to greenhouse gases, the chief of them being anthropogenic carbon dioxide emissions. This global climate change, though, manifests itself in different ways at regional scales or local scales. So some areas can have like excessive warming, some can get colder in the winters, some areas might have exacerbated droughts, some have more floods. So this is all part of the system and often driven by this warming, global warming. So if you have to think about it slightly more technically, the global warming can be considered as a thermodynamic change, so that's the thermal response to warming, whereas these local changes are more reliant on what are called dynamics of the system. So they depend on circulation, for example, like while this carbon dioxide forcing, as scientists call it, which is global, may not change from, you know, between yesterday and today. I live in Edinburgh, and if the wind blows from the north, that circulation, right, essentially that will be colder than if it blows from the south. So that's an example to kind of contrast the global versus the local change.
For the past few decades, experts and institutes have struggled to build Earth system models. How should our listeners understand the current best level of climate models?
Right. The current generation of climate models, or the state-of-the-art models, are also called Earth system models, and that's because they have these coupling across systems for domains, like you have a land model, an ocean model, and a model for the atmosphere, and they're all like coupled together. But they also have what's called an interactive carbon cycle. So carbon moves across these domains. And we are currently in, and most of these, well, all of these models pretty much are part of what is called the Coupled Model Intercomparison Project. So the abbreviation for that is CMIP. And we are in the sixth generation of these models. And these models support important reports such as the IPCC assessment reports by providing the underpinning science for these reports. Now, these models have quite advanced capabilities. They're scientifically very advanced. And we have also seen significant improvements across generations of models. So if we just look at the current sixth generation, as I said, and, you know, and compare it to the fifth, there are some significant changes in things like how ocean biogeochemistry is represented, Indian monsoon modeling, atmospheric circulation over Europe. So these are like some examples from the literature of, you know, where people have analyzed these model projections and seen that scientific advancements have been made. Having said that, though, these models still have challenges. So due to computational constraints, these models operate at spatial scales of like 100 kilometers or thereabouts, which means that they are not the best really at capturing processes, like some of these dynamic processes that I said, which occur at like, you know, fewer kilometer scale. So that's something that we kind of like have to address still. Another example, I talked to you about the carbon cycle, right? So you know that plants take up carbon dioxide, but they're also very sensitive to temperature. So if it gets very hot due to the warming, they will reduce their uptake of carbon dioxide. So how much they take in, how much that reduces, these are all not necessarily governed by physical equations, right? So these are all harder to model. So we do still have challenges in climate modeling. But overall, the scientific advancement is quite good.
One of the problems to solve, how much heat, compared to pre-industrial times, will be experienced for a given level of carbon dioxide in the air? And one standard that's been used is what to expect if there's twice as much carbon dioxide, say 500 or 560 parts per million compared to pre-industrial, whenever that occurs. How would you explain the difficult-to-understand debate about so-called Earth-climate sensitivity and the refinement of that used in your paper?
In our paper, we address that. And what we show through two key results is that that's not necessarily the case. So our first key result is that effective climate sensitivity is not universally correlated with what are regional climate drivers for impacts. And we show that by taking up different climate impacts or climate drivers for those regional impacts, and also by looking across different regions in the world. The second finding, the second result that we thought was really interesting that came about is models have what is called internal variability. So what that means is smallest changes in initial conditions can produce slight variations in the model simulations. And at regional scales, these changes have those initial disturbances and changes resulting from that can be a lot more than the global forced CO2 or greenhouse gas warming signal. So that's, again, the kind of like the dynamical or the small circulation kind of small-scale changes. So what we saw that if you take a model, and climate models don't produce just one simulation per model, they produce what's called an ensemble. And if you look at the ensemble, all these ensemble members have the same value for climate sensitivity because they're part of the same model. But the spread in these ensembles often is as large as the spread across models. So what that then means, again, that further weakens this correlation of like climate sensitivity with these regional impacts. So this is another interesting thing that came about. So we hope that this is something that the scientific community and the policymakers and stuff kind of like understand that this is a very nuanced thing. And, you know, this debate about removing models based on climate sensitivity is not something that we should do.
And then American scientist Zeke Hausfather published a paper a couple of years ago saying these higher range models should be left out when we're dealing with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. In your new work, supported by a lot of testing, and you've got a really good group working with you, your team suggests these models should be used. In a nutshell, why?
Yep, it leads directly from your previous question. So, yes, again, so the Hausfather et al.'s paper basically said that, you know, these high climate sensitivity models should be excluded from impact studies. And the underlying reason for that was that these are unrealistic because the climate sensitivities are not what we really expect to see. However, what we look at are, you know, specifically, like I said, we don't look at impacts as such. Like we're not talking like, you know, what flooding does as such, but we look at the climate drivers for these regional impacts. So, for example, when we look at floods, we look at five-day total rainfall, right, and how that changes and how is that correlated with climate sensitivity. And what we found was that there is no universal correlation. So it's possible that the global warming temperature, which is essentially plays a bigger role for certain impacts, but it doesn't for all impacts. It doesn't across all regions, which obviously then means that, you know, we shouldn't exclude these models. They should be included for regional impact studies. And also, as I mentioned, there is quite an overlap in the range of these drivers, as we see across models and across inside within model ensembles as well. So again, the point I'd like to kind of reiterate is that a lot depends on how these local scale and dynamic processes are also represented in these climate models. While for some impacts, the global warming or temperature change may be the key factor, it may not and will not be for others, as we show in the paper. The takeaway message then is that, you know, we should include these high climate sensitivity models also. Otherwise, we might actually risk missing out on potential real impacts, which can have serious consequences.
Indeed. And your new work, published December 5th, puts the spotlight on three threats: flooding, drought, and fires. And your paper brings together nicely the various forces enabling these big events that make headlines. I found your summary very useful. Let's take them one at a time, starting with flooding. Why did you pick monsoon rains on several continents as a case study in flooding?
Monsoon rains supply water for more than a third of the world's population, approximately, and often these are populations in developing countries. Monsoon flooding can cause severe damage, right, to infrastructure, to lives, livelihood, crops. They can spread diseases. So as we are seeing an increase in population, there's a need to maintain food and water security. So having a good idea of how severe monsoon flooding will change in the future is really important for these communities and for future planning by governments. So we thought this was a very important impact to pick and consider for our study.
And there's been a lot of debate recently about particles in the air called aerosols and global warming. Talk to us about the role of aerosols in the monsoons, and does that include the infamous smog floating across large parts of India, China, and Indonesia?
Yes, aerosols are complex. I mean, they have a complex effect on monsoon. So we discuss in the paper the contrasting effect they may have, but for the purpose of this interview, I'll focus on the primary thing that they do. So what aerosols do is they reflect away solar radiation. So they actually have a cooling effect on the planet. And in the past, this cooling effect has offset anywhere from 30 to 40% of the warming due to CO2. So you can see that it has a really important effect. Monsoon, the strength of the monsoon is one of the key factors, you know, that's responsible for the strength of the monsoon, is the difference in the temperature between the land and the ocean. Now, aerosols produce this cooling effect, and so that difference kind of like weakens, and so the strength of the monsoon weakens as well. So that's the big effect that aerosols effectively have on monsoons. And the smog over parts of Asia and so on, yes, they definitely play a role. But governments all over, right, particularly in developing countries, they are very invested in mitigating the effect, or like mitigating the smog and the aerosols and like reducing pollution, because it primarily has a huge benefit for people living there, right, for human health. However, irrespective of what all of this does and how this goes, by reducing aerosols, and, you know, mechanisms are already in place to reduce these aerosols in the future, what will happen is that it will lead to an increase in regional as well as global warming, because that cooling effect is taken away.
And there are long-range teleconnections between these big monsoon rainfall systems, but I think it's just too complicated for this radio interview. They are listed and explained in the paper. The point is, there are very large interactive systems at play that arch over continents and oceans, and it's not just temperature increases. Does your paper, though, discount the role of global warming in floods or drought?
No. We definitely do not discount the role of warming in any of the impacts. So warming does play a role. How big a role is what matters, right? So what we want to convey is that global warming or the global temperature change is but one factor that influences these regional climate drivers that are responsible, you know, for impact. This may not be the global temperature change may not be the most important factor, but it can be in some cases. So essentially, what we're trying to say is that where, as far as like what climate models do is concerned, it's important to also understand how well they model these local scale processes as well. And that's why we shouldn't just remove any models from a study on impacts or impact assessments just based on this climate sensitivity.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Dr. Swaminathan, let's talk about drought. Pretty well all the projections show the number of droughts increases in the future, but there are so many factors at work. For example, there will be changes to atmospheric circulation and even the jet stream as the climate shifts. How do you know the sensitivity of climate to greenhouse gases is not the deciding factor in droughts?
Warming does play a role. And as you can see in the paper, that the drought events, so we use a metric for droughts, and we see that there is an increase in the future pretty much across models. The primary effect that this warming has on droughts is something called evapotranspiration, which is essentially evaporation plus transpiration. So that's basically water drying up, right? However, where, when, and how often drought occurs matters more on, or depends more on, local processes, with circulation being key here, and that's a dynamic process. There are also other things like how the land, atmosphere, and vegetation interact, and that plays a role as well. So what our results show, that excluding these factors and looking just at the climate sensitivity, shows that it has no correlation to the drought metric. So this is clearly evidence that other factors must be considered for an impact or a metric for drought.
And likewise, with a chorus of other published science, you find fire weather days are projected to increase in the future. We have to be careful here because last August, for example, there were loud and official warnings of extreme fire-ready conditions in the Pacific Northwest of North America, but it was quiet for a while as far as fires go. What make wildfire predictions so difficult?
So fire is a very complex thing. There's a difference between fire risk and actual fires, as you've just said from your example. So let's just take a few of the, you know, like why this is complex, right? So there are different factors that contribute to fires occurring. So there's the physical climate itself, right? Temperature, whether it's hot or cold, dryness, how much moisture there is, how much moisture there is in the soil, what is the speed of the wind, what direction is the wind flowing. So those are some physical climate characteristics. Then there is this need for fuel to burn, right? So what kind of vegetation is there? What is the moisture content of that vegetation? And then there's things like the sources, right, or ignition, or the ability for the fire to get extinguished or spread. Ignition itself can be natural, like lightning strikes, or human-induced. And one study actually found that if you have accessible pathways to, you know, potential ignition points, then there's a higher risk of fire because people can actually travel and set off fires because there's a way to get to those points. I mean, and these are very hard to model, right? And then finally, there's also the local dynamics, which kind of we're seeing a pattern here, right? So I think a couple of years ago in the Pacific Northwest, the heavy fire season, part of the reason it kind of continued on was because there was a stationary pressure system. And so the circulation there was a factor in how long the fire and, you know, the actual fire lasted for. So how all these factors combine and come together determines actual fires occurring and evolving. With climate model simulations, you can make some estimates. I mean, like, so basically what climate model simulations can tell us is essentially about the physical climate aspect. But some of these other things are much harder. So that's why we have this notion of, you know, like flagging high fire risk days. But actual fires may or may not occur depending on how these factors come together.
As I understand it, and I'm not great with this, but the largest single Earth model project, the Coupled Model Intercomparison Project, or CMIP, chose just 18 models for integration. And I know they were trying for accuracy and projections that would be useful for governments, but they left out models allowing higher possible temperatures. Can you give us examples of models that were left out and maybe should be used, and where are they located?
So the CMIP project itself consists of a larger set of models. So it's about 50 models, and from around 50 modeling centers, though each model doesn't necessarily produce, each center doesn't necessarily produce a model. This is very highly collaborative science. For example, the IPCC AR6 report, so that's this AR stands for assessment report, and we've had the sixth report, which is the most recent one, uses most of these models. So the CMIP models kind of contribute to the underpinning science of these assessment reports. Essentially, that report as such does not decide what models to pick. It kind of relies on peer-reviewed scientific literature. So in those reports, you'll see that more than 18 models are represented. The number 18 is basically models, the number of models we used in our study. And you will see in the paper that that number is not constant across the three different impacts we look at. Part of that reason was the availability of the variables needed to calculate. So I talked about the regional climate drivers. So some of that data was not available across all the models. But we started off with a set of around 20 to 22 models, and we came to this 18. And those models were picked because they captured a wide range of ECS values, because our study was focused on that. And these models were also scientifically different. That is, they came from different modeling centers, because sometimes the same modeling center will develop multiple models, and you won't see too much of a climate sensitivity difference across those. So some of those may just be higher resolution and lower resolution and so on. And we also wanted to kind of have when we looked at this diversity in the models, we wanted to capture maximum diversity. So part of it was different modeling centers. Part of it was also ensuring models that had different component models. So sometimes climate models share a land model or an ocean model, and we wanted to kind of have a breadth across all of this. So that's how we kind of used our expertise to handpick models that was an effective subset, and it captured this variability across models. We hypothesized that if we show that climate sensitivity has no universal correlation across regional impact drivers from data from these models, then effectively we are able to show that across a wide range of ECS values, scientifically different climate models, there is no correlation between climate sensitivity and these regional impact drivers, and that can kind of drive the message home effectively.
Well, given historic damages already, we've seen a lot of disasters. It's easy to be paranoid. Is it possible when it comes to the IPCC that high warming models would be excluded to force agreement to official figures? Or is this just a discussion among scientists trying to get the best possible results?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very valid question. There's the whole reasoning behind why we had these publications saying high climate sensitivity models should not be included in these kind of impact studies was, again, because people felt that this might be unrealistic. But really, as I said, the IPCC, in fact, the IPCC's Chapter 7 in the most recent assessment report actually comes out and explicitly says that no single model should be removed from any study because of climate sensitivity. So in our paper, essentially, we show that this notion of this unrealistic future outcomes is not true, right? So, and I believe that, the scientific community wants to provide robust and reliable science. So concerns should be raised, and these concerns should be addressed in a scientific, rational manner. This science is then used for policy adaptation. It's used by insurance companies. It's used by government, in terms of like what models to pick for like future assessments and so on. So I feel that this is a really important result, not just scientifically, but also for society. And so, it kind of spans, it goes beyond just the science of model development, is what I think.
We know about machine learning for climate research. I've had a number of authors lately say, yes, we used machine learning in this. Has artificial intelligence already arrived in the field?
Indeed, yes. So machine learning is being used for both climate modeling as well as weather forecasting. It's at different stages in these two things. I would say weather forecasting, the use of machine learning has advanced a lot more than climate modeling. And there are different reasons for that, because for climate models, you have other considerations like the long-term physical stability of climate closures, of energy and things. So those things have to be maintained. So that's part of the reason. But I would say, yes, machine learning has arrived in climate modeling.
And a couple of years ago, I asked an eminent scientist this question: do you foresee artificial intelligence, as it comes through vast amounts of data, generating not just answers that we were looking for, but valid and useful questions that humans have not yet considered? He answered, never. You?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So I would say that machine learning has the capacity, right? Like, you can comb through vast troves of data and you can recognize patterns. So yes, you can do that. But I would also advise caution, because using machine learning, you can always find patterns. Whether they make sense, that's a different question. So I would definitely not discount domain expertise for climate modeling as such. I think that's definitely a very important component. And you can't just let these machine learning algorithms like do everything. And I'd just like to highlight one point. You mentioned combing through vast amounts of data, right? So that data itself comes from models that were constructed using domain expertise and, you know, physical sciences. So, yeah, I just want to point that out.
So by domain expertise, you actually mean scientists?
I mean climate scientists, yeah. Atmospheric scientists, yeah. Yes, indeed, yes.
Ranjini, what got you into this highly technical field of climate modeling?
It was two things, right? So first of all, my background is in computer science. I'm a computer scientist, and my background is using machine learning and AI for natural language processing and so on. But I found that these skills were very well suited for climate model data analysis, feeding back into, you know, like evaluating models, feeding that back for model development, and using machine learning for aspects of model development as well. So that's one aspect in terms of like skill set. But the other was also this motivation, right, and concern for what I think is the biggest crisis humanity faces, right, for our future generations and stuff. So when I got an opportunity to work in this area, I just couldn't say no.
From the University of Reading, we have been speaking with climate model expert Ranjini Swaminathan. She is lead author of the new paper, Regional Impacts Poorly Constrained by Climate Sensitivity. You can find more links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Ranjini, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. It seems appropriate that we are now going to two speakers from the conference, Techno-Utopians and the Fate of the Earth. It was held in New York City on October 25th and 26th, 2014. This teach-in was presented by the International Forum on Globalization and the New York Open Center. It was recorded by Dale Lehman of WZRD Radio. Starting with Charlene Spretnak on The Resurgence of the Real.
And our final panelist today will be Charlene Spretnak. She is the co-founder of the U.S. Green Party and the author of Green Politics, The Resurgence of the Real, Relational Reality, and many eco-social essays. She was named by the British government as one of the 100 eco-heroes of all time. And her newest book, The Spiritual Dynamic in Modern Art, was just published this week. Charlene will be speaking today on the importance of understanding organic, dynamic interrelatedness in assessing technology. Welcome, Charlene.
I'm going to come at this subject from a somewhat different direction, building on these astute critiques my fellow panelists have given about essentially a lot of examples they stated from what is the mechanistic worldview. And that, of course, has shaped our systems of knowledge. It shaped the way we were all socialized and the way we relate to technology. So the mechanistic worldview holds that every person and every entity is essentially separate and discrete. And entities, whether they're people or marsupials or poplar trees, they can be in some kind of relationship or not. But that certainly doesn't affect their internal constitution and the way they function physically. So that's the mechanistic perspective. But there's also a relational perspective, which acknowledges that every entity exists in a field of dynamic interrelationships, and they definitely do affect how your internal organ systems work and how you function in the world. And the interrelationships are dynamic, meaning they're always in flux, they respond to minute changes, they're creative, unpredictable, and full of possibilities. Now, even in the 19th century, there were some people who saw there are some real problems with the assumptions and premises of the mechanistic worldview. And really, there's been this attempted correction of it going on, at least since 1905 with Einstein's two papers, which established a relational perspective on matter and energy. But it's turned out that the mechanistic worldview has been very difficult to dislodge. And you may remember that there were a number of best-selling books in the last quarter of the 20th century, and these were all about the implications of relational discoveries in quantum physics, and then chaos theory, and then complexity studies. And these books asserted that soon this relational thinking from these discoveries would ripple out and transform all our institutions. Right. We can look around and see that our institutions were not transformed. And I think that's probably because the nature of those discoveries was too abstract for most people to pay a lot of attention to. But the millennial turning came and went, and I was still waiting to see the big correction, the grand correction to the mechanistic worldview. So I had bulging files of this eventually, and I drew them all together and presented them in this book, Relational Reality, a couple of years ago. So I'm going to give you just a few examples. One of them was they did a study a few years ago of 906 elderly adults, and they found that the ones that had few friendships or other social interactions had a rapid decline in motor function, standing, gripping, balancing. And then there was a study 2 years ago, 2012. This is about children, the development of children. And they found that children who between ages 5 and 10 experience violence, either physically being brought on them or even witnessing violence, those children then had an erosion in the telomeres, which is part of the DNA structures in their cells, a shortening of the telomeres, which is what happens in the aging process. And the study found that the more types of violence the child witnessed, the faster the telomeres eroded, shortening their lifespan. So direct and even observed violence affects the human body at the cellular level. And then also our body-mind is in dynamic relationship not only with other people, but with the rest of the natural world. So one study a few years ago of people who live in the projects in Chicago, in this one housing project, it found that the residents who were at the far end of the project, next to trees and green open space, they not only had less anxiety and depression, but they had many fewer incidents of physical diseases, like diabetes, asthma, intestinal problems, and back pains. So there are so many, actually, recent discoveries about the relationship between humans and nature that you may have noticed that hospitals have now redesigned their decor to have nature motifs, which costs a lot of money. So that's how established it is, only in the last 12 years with all this research. And if you've been in a hospital recently, you may have noticed the drapery often has a leaf motif. And in the patient's room, they've put a big photograph of a mountain scene. And in the corridors, they have these little water fountains, you know, with water running over stones. And sometimes in the MRI room, the last thing people see when they're being rolled in is the blue sky with white, fluffy clouds. So the reason they're doing that is because it's been very firmly established that connecting with nature, even through a photograph, helps our healing process. And I call this new field of knowledge that's emerging relational physiology. It's different, I feel, because these discoveries, unlike the earlier ones, are so concrete and so accessible, and it's moving very quickly into mainstream areas. But what I'd like to focus on in the time remaining is just one of our organs, the brain, because it's always been held in the mechanistic view of the human body-mind, of course, that we arrive in this world with a certain capacity of mental functioning. You might be born smart or born dumb or something in between, but it's understood that you arrive with a certain kind of brain, and that's it. Now, however, that assumption is being strongly challenged by several studies that found there are numerous relational factors from infancy on through childhood that affect the development of an adult's level of intelligence. So here are five examples of what I call the relational physiology of intelligence. The first one's breastfeeding. So researchers have realized for a long time that breastfeeding is good for the physical reason that there are neurosugars in the breast milk that helps brain development. But now studies have also determined that the hours of interaction between the mother and the baby are exchanging all kinds of information through touch and language and other body language that stimulates brain development. And one study said that it controlled for lots of socioeconomic factors, but it said a baby who is breastfed for 1 year without other food being added yet gets a 6-point bounce on an IQ test, even though we know there are problems with IQ tests, but a standardized intelligence test. 6 points is what they determined. Number two, certain brain disorders. There's the example of autism. This is a new study that was just published last month by the University of California at Davis. You cannot make a definite diagnosis of autism before age 2, but as young as 6 months, certain symptoms start to show up, like rapid eye movement or fixation, unusual fixation on an object, or abnormal repetitive movements and not wanting to make eye contact. So this study identified a number of infants who were symptomatic between ages 6 months and 1 year, and it divided them into four groups. One of the groups got this therapy called Early Start, and they trained the mothers and sometimes both parents, how to do certain motions, certain sounds, often down on the carpet with the child, certain movements every day. And by the time these babies were 3 years old, the group that had had the early start intervention had no symptoms of autism, no language delays, and no other developmental delays. So this relational interaction had affected the brain and probably the synaptic pathways. And then number three, family dynamics. Well, about 25 years ago, it was noticed by some researchers that, again, drawing on the IQ test, the firstborn child, eldest child in a family, tends to generally, score 2 or 3 points higher on the IQ test than his or her siblings. So, of course, they figured it must be something going on with the brain of the firstborn. But in 2007, a study was done in Norway of 2,041 military records of 18 and 19-year-old boys who have to go into the service. And the researchers then, looking at these records, had not only the IQ score of the test the military had given, but it also had the family history of each boy. And what they found was, if the firstborn child had died early in childhood, or even if the first two children had died early and the thirdborn had been raised as the eldest, that child then scored the extra 2 or 3 points on the IQ test at age 19 that's generally seen of the firstborns. So family dynamics were affecting the development expression of intelligence. And they didn't speculate why, but, you know, parents tend to give the eldest child more responsibility, watch the kids, we're going out, and the eldest tends to identify more with the adult world and test-taking. It might have something to do with that, but they didn't say. And then, number four, violation and damage to the developmental process. It's been found in many studies, cross-culturally, that whipping, spanking, beating a child lowers IQ. And the more spanking, the more it lowers the IQ. And culturally, if it's accepted and expected that all children will be whipped or spanked, you can see culturally, collectively, the scores are suppressed, even factoring in for socioeconomic factors. So the violence is apparently an anti-relational trauma to the whole system. And then last, number five, language and the relational formation of our intelligence. A researcher named Betty Hart found in the mid-1990s that children who were exposed to a lot of language in conversation before age three did much better in reading and math and intelligence tests in school than children who had heard many fewer words during that period. So there's been a lot of studies recently working off of that and developing it. And one thing they found is that if the child was hearing a lot of words in conversation, not from the mother or primary caregiver, but rather from the television set, it not only didn't have the same effect, it had a detrimental effect on their intelligence abilities later. Before I go on, let me just say the baby Einstein device, do you remember that? Why that went by the by? When those children got to first and second grade, they had lower ability than the ones. So what I started to say before I thought of that, you cannot substitute the organic with a technological and expect that it's not going to be damaging. And that fact is apparently very widely recognized among high-tech parents in Silicon Valley. You may have seen some of these articles in the paper where they go to these big names and say, wow, your house must be like an electronic cottage, the journalist will say. And the guy's, no, we don't let our kids go on that. And they said, really, you don't? No, they, you know, either have no televisions and computers in the house or screen time, or at a certain age, they'll let them have 1 or 2 hours a week. Or they send them even to Waldorf schools, no TV in the house. So one of the journalists asked these high-tech couples why they keep their children away from screen time, and they replied, quote, because we've seen what it does to people who were raised that way, unquote. Meanwhile, of course, their own company's marketing departments are just going full bore to convince parents all across the country that it'll benefit their child hugely to have them glued to a screen from infancy on, when, in fact, this electronic immersion is tremendously damaging to their development. So, in summary, we are just now beginning to grasp in mainstream venues that we human organisms are far, far more dynamically interrelated than modern thinking ever assumed. And of course, this deeply relational nature of reality was and is self-evident to indigenous cultures, but we hypermodern folks are pretty much at a kindergarten level of figuring out our own physical nature and how we work. It's not the way we were schooled. So one way for us to assess the effects of technology in our lives is to pay attention to whether time spent on an electronic device is significantly reducing the time and availability we need for organic relationships. But we face two difficulties in making assessments like that. First, because modern people are socialized in the mechanistic worldview, every new device seems really swell, and we're slow to see the detrimental effects. And second, because we do not yet recognize all that needs to be protected in this life, it's hard for us to make those assessments. But just keep in mind that we exist in, each of us, every moment, we're embedded in these gazillions of organic dynamic relationships. It's exhilarating. Thank you.
You just heard Charlene Spretnak, a founder of the U.S. Green Party, author and ecofeminist. Our next speaker from the forum Techno-Utopians and the Fate of the Earth is the famous ecofeminist Susan Griffin. Her topic is Women in Nature, Speed, Consciousness, and Quantification.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Next, I'd like to welcome Susan Griffin. Susan is a poet, essayist, playwright, and screenwriter. She's the author of over 20 books, including Women in Nature, which inspired the eco-feminist movement. Her book on nuclear weapons, A Chorus of Stones, The Private Life of War, was a New York Times notable book and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Susan was named by Utney Reader as one of 100 visionaries for the new millennium. Thank you, and welcome, Susan.
I contemplate a tree. I can assign it to a species and observe it as an instance. I can dissolve it into a number, but it can also happen, if will and grace are joined, that as I contemplate the tree, I am drawn into a relation, and the tree ceases to be an it. Those are the words that Martin Buber wrote in 1923 in his classic, I, Thou. I think what we're stating here today is that what we have in our society today is an I-it, not an I-thou relationship with nature. And that I-it, by the way, relationship extends to various groups within our culture, the way we view indigenous peoples, the way we view women, the way we view people of color, is also tends to be more objectifying and closer to an it than a thou. But at the same time, you know, more science is discovering intelligence in the universe and in nature. Every day I learn about something, it seems that I learn about something new, some way that plants have intelligence, extraordinary. The abstract thinking of slime mold, have you heard about that? It's quite amazing. They can solve these incredible labyrinthine problems. But we still are hanging on to this experiential attitude. We may have a cognitive recognition of intelligence and or soul or an inner life in nature, but we hang on to this idea of the universe as essentially dead. And that creates some problems for us. It leads to global warming, it leads to economic inequities, but there's also another problem which is essentially psychological. And this psychological problem reinforces the economic and social attitudes that we have that are exploiting the earth. And that is that we can't have a meaningful relationship anymore with many of us with nature. And that's because it's very difficult to maintain or to even initiate a stimulating relationship with a corpse. So we've got some solutions though. A solution like the steam train, which really inaugurated, in many ways, the Industrial Revolution. The steam train had another purpose, and that was it functioned as a kind of mechanical Viagra, for both sexes, of course. It brought excitement back into life. Now, of course, the steam train promised a kind of utopia, as every new invention does. Mark Secund, for instance, who was an inventor of the wide cable suspension bridge, you know, wrote that the enjoyment, the commodities of life, which had been reserved for only men of fortune, will be shared by all classes. Now, in fact, we know that that's not at all what happened with the Industrial Revolution, nor with the steam train, that the Industrial Revolution led to terrible economic inequality as people took the train into the cities. There was a surplus of labor, and in addition to that, children were exploited in labor. But clearly, at the same time, the steam trade had something really thrilling to offer, and Secund talks about that. Long ribbons of iron, along which rush, rapid as thought, those fordable machines, which seem to eat up space with a spontaneous impatience and which seem almost alive in their breathing and their movement. So you can see the erotic nature of this great love of steam trains. So here's the incredible thing. The formidable erotic powers of the steam train seem to restore the life force that our worldview had stolen from nature, even while it was instrumental in destroying nature. Does anybody know what this is here? Bison skulls. So what would happen is on the steam trains that went west, one of the attractions of that rail trip to the west was that the train would stop in certain places where buffalo herds roamed, and the men on the train could get off and they could shoot. And so the buffalo almost became extinct. In the early part of the 19th century, speed itself became the object of adulation. It was worshipped by many, including, especially, the Italian writer and founder of a movement called Futurism, F.T. Marinetti. And I'm going to read you a few words from an essay he wrote called The New Religion, Morality of Speed. The futurist morality will protect man against the inevitable decay produced by slowness, memory, analysis, rest, and habit. Human energy, multiplied by 100-fold by velocity, will dominate space and time. Velocity has given human life one of the attributes of divinity, the straight line. Velocity is naturally pure, slowness is naturally unclean. After destroying traditional good and evil, we are creating a new good, speed, and a new evil, slowness. We intend to glorify war. This is from another piece that he wrote called The Futurist Manifesto. He wrote, "We intend to glorify war, the only hygiene of the world, militarism, patriotism, beautiful ideas worth dying for, and contempt for women." You see the way that all of these things fit together? Marinetti became... He was the head of what was the Futurist Political Party, which merged in Italy with the Fascist Party. And he became a staunch supporter of Mussolini, leading to this. Doesn't that look like those bison skulls? You know, that's Florence after a bombardment in World War II. So seeing nature as dead, then we create our own deaths. But instead of questioning our worldview at any point, we simply accelerate our efforts to awaken ourselves, to re-stimulate ourselves. So we've come up with a new kind of Viagra, and that is electronic Viagra. So I thought of this when I saw an ad for some sort of, I don't know what it was, for some sort of software, something to do with computers. It was something that was a faster connection. It probably had to do with the internet, and it was faster, because speed is the most important element that is advertised for anything in the world of computers right now. So shows a guy, and he's getting this really fast connection, and he declares, "I never felt more alive." But actually, what a computer is it's a simulacrum of life, and it's dead. It's a dead simulacrum of life, what you're seeing on the screen. So once again, the claim was made with computers is that it's going to equalize everything. It's going to put us all on an equal footing, especially politically. We're going to be able to get the word out, and to some extent we can do that. But what the computer, with its speed, is best at is accumulating big data. And big data is very good for accumulating big wealth. So that's its main function in the business world. And I want to quote to you from Emma Uprichard, who, from the University of Warwick. She's a professor of sociology. And this is what she has to say about big data. It's being presented as the future problem solver for all things, from breast cancer to low-cost governance, from better security to predictive systems, from smart cities and better traffic and water systems to an end to urban squalor. It promises cleaner, more sustainable, renewable energy, better banking, better governance, better education for all, more efficient, faster, more cost-effective everything. If we thought utopian authors were full of hope for better futures, the public discourse of big data is akin to a future fairy godmother with a magic wand granting wishes to help solve some of the world's most wicked problems. Of course, you know, I'm not arguing here against the collection of data at all. I love the data about the 99%, for instance, versus the 1%. There's some very important data that is also being, young people are being studied, and it's found, for instance, that in the United States, young people tend to be 75 times more violent than young people in other nations. So this kind of data is useful. But numbers are stripped of the earth. They're stripped of place. I mean, the numbers, the big data, the computers have realized Marinetti's dream. They're stripped of place, time. They're stripped of also stories, breakfast, lunch, dinner, smiles, tears, empathy, emotional intelligence, not to speak of, in fact, the real erotic mysteries that come to us from sunrise, sunset, the night sky, a flight of birds, migrating south through the summer, or the eyes of somebody we love. numbers don't have any of that. That's their virtue. They're supposedly objective, and therefore they're placed, by the way, above human responses and above us. For instance, you know, I hate public polls, and I hate polls of all kinds and questionnaires. For instance, if I'm asked, you know, have you ever been arrested? I would have to say yes, I was arrested. And then that would place me closer on a scale to a psychopath because I've been arrested. That's part of the data that makes you a psychopath. However, it doesn't ask me what I was arrested for or why I was arrested. I was arrested once protesting apartheid, once protesting the build-up to the war in Iraq, and another time because I refused to move when I was witnessing an incident, incidents of police brutality. There's this other idea that somehow the data is never wrong, but it's often wrong because the data comes from ultimately a subjective viewpoint. This idea that an objective viewpoint is possible is not even possible in science, much less in social science. What we're doing is we're completing a sort of ultimate feedback cycle. Another way to think about it is that it's a very elaborate Ponzi scheme. You know, we're promised that we're going to get rich, but actually it's impoverishing us all. Not only is it impoverishing the environment, but we're starting to impoverish ourselves. When we impoverish our idea of the body and the way we heal and approach the body, that's a very serious lessening of ourselves, of our being. But what we're also impoverishing right now is consciousness. Ironically, we start with an epistemology saying there's an I and an it. And the I is supposed to be ensouled and have intelligence and empathy, and the it is an object. Now we're making consciousness itself into an it.
At this point, to meet our time limitations, I removed a few minutes of Susan Griffin's comments on education in the United States. We'll go to her conclusion, which follows from her beginning remarks.
I'm going to end with a quote because there are many cultures that still do carry an understanding of nature as thou and live by that. And I'm going to quote you from a poem by the Senegalese poet. I'm going to end with these words. From the Senegalese poet Tiro Seydou Sall. Having become choreographers, the stars orchestrate in their white robes, tapestries of dreams, pain and joy, pulsations of love in the heart of life.
That was ecofeminist Susan Griffin. These presentations come from the New York City teach-in at the end of October called Techno-Utopians and the Fate of the Earth. Our recordings are courtesy of Dale Lehman of WZRD Radio. That's it for this week. Join me again for Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We'll be right back.